What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. I'm recording this on Friday, April 4th. And, you know, we are really in the stretch run of the season right now. Only about five or six games remaining for pretty much every team. A lot of seed jockeying going on right now for the teams competing for the playoffs. And so on that topic, just going to go through a lot of the playoff teams and talk stock up and stock down on a handful of them. Some of them are trending in the right direction at the right time. Some of them trending in the wrong direction right before the postseason. So going to go through a handful of them, talk through the teams playing well, not playing well. What does that mean for them come postseason time? Should we be worried about the struggling teams? Will the teams that are hot translate to the postseason? Everything along those lines. Additionally, just going to wrap up at the end with a couple other things, such as the Taylor Jenkins firing, the Oklahoma City Thunder and their historic season this year, and then a little talk about Josh Giddey. So with that being said, let's go ahead and get right into it. So before we get into the stock up, stock down exercise, I did just want to talk about the news that came out last week. And it's been right about exactly a week at this point. It was last Friday when the news came out that Taylor Jenkins was being fired as the head coach for the Memphis Grizzlies, who's going to be replaced by this interim coach from Finland. I'm probably going to botch his name. Tomas Isalo. Sorry, not exactly up on my Finnish. But yeah, he is now going to finish the year as the head coach for the Grizzlies, and Jenkins is officially out, which this was definitely pretty shocking for a number of reasons, the timing being one of them. But obviously, like, Jenkins has been a really successful coach for Memphis, and he obviously has shown some flaws, but he is the winningest coach in franchise history with a 250-217 record overall. That's about an average of 44 wins per season if you do it over an 82-game schedule. And if you take out the totally injury-riddled season that the Grizzlies had last year, which obviously was completely out of his control, I think Memphis broke the record for most players played in one season, because that's how much they were wrecked by injuries. Then he's played at about a 47 win pace throughout his time in Memphis. And this is not a very successful franchise over the, I mean, they're one of the expansion teams from the 90s, and they, you know, only 25 ish years of existence or something along those lines. So it's not like Memphis has been some juggernaut or some great history. So Jenkins really has coached them through the best years of this franchise's history. They've only finished above 500 14 times in their history, and Jenkins has coached four of those teams in only six seasons. So four of the six seasons he was above 500, which, you know, given the history of this franchise, that's really good. And he has two of the best four seasons in team history as well, including a franchise best 56 wins back in 2022. He's been the two seed multiple times in 22 and 23, and sat at the two seed for large portions of this year as well before they kind of fell off the rails a little bit, that eventually led to likely his firing. But this season, I mean, they started 35-16. They sat at the two seed, but they have really sputtered as of late. They're 10-16 since then. Of course, some of those losses coming after his firing, but they fell all the way from the two seed down to as low as the eight seed. They're currently in the six seed just because of their win last night, but they've been in the bottom third of the league defensively in that span, and they have not beaten a team above 500 since February 2nd. So a full 2 months, over 2 months at this point, and their 10 wins are over, you know, the Suns three times, the Jazz twice, the Heat twice, the Magic, the Mavs without AD, the Pelicans. So it has not been really that impressive, the wins they have had, and they just pretty much can pencil them in for a loss every time they've played a semi-decent team over the last 2 months now. And I don't think that they're going to fire a dude just because a 10-16 stretch, you know what I mean? It's not ideal, but Memphis has pretty much met expectations for what people probably thought they would be this year. I don't think anybody thought they would be a top one or two seed in the West. I think they thought they'd be vying for a playoff spot, which they absolutely are right now, in that sort of 5-8 range, which again, that's where they are right now. And I think there's got to be more to this, because there was some writing on the wall in the offseason when the front office basically fired his entire coaching staff and revamped it with handpicked people on their end. Zach Kleiman, the GM, did this. And so you have to wonder if maybe there were some stylistic differences between the front office and Jenkins, if there was maybe some things behind the scenes that we either don't know about yet or will come out later, because it really seemed like it revolved around revamping the half court offense, because they have not been good there. And so, you know, this is, it's fair to criticize that part of what Jenkins has done for this team. I mean, they were 29th in half court offense last year, 22nd the year before that, 22nd the year before that, and 26th the year before that. So they've been basically a bottom five half court offense in the Taylor Jenkins era. And this year they're at 14th. So, you know, they've improved a bit. So you have to wonder if maybe some of the coaching changes and stylistic changes have benefited them. But, you know, it's fair to be frustrated in Jenkins's situation, where when you're the coach, you don't want the front office kind of breathing down your neck, telling you how to do your job. You want the autonomy to put the rotation and the styles and the schemes out there that you think is going to put the team in best position to win, because that's what they hired you to do. And so it seems like they kind of forced his hand. Their offense was a lot different this year. They were very pick and roll heavy in the past, and bottom of the league this year in terms of pick and rolls and screens in general. They have sort of de-emphasized John Morant as a focal point offensively. Desmond Bane's usage is down. Jaren Jackson Jr. has been more involved. A lot of the role guys getting maybe a little bit more touches than in the past. So you wonder if maybe Jenkins didn't fully buy into what they wanted or how they wanted the offense to be run. And so my take overall on this is that, look, I understand the firing to an extent. You know, Jenkins has his flaws. He obviously could not control Dylan Brooks and his sporadic offensive play with Memphis. Like, you look at Brooks in Houston now, and he's thriving and playing within his role, and Jenkins could not get him to do that. He just couldn't get him to buy into the role that they needed him to play, and Udoka clearly has been able to do that. So that has to fall back on Jenkins a little bit. You know, the half-court struggles on offense have been real. I went through those numbers. You know, they were a bottom five team in that area really throughout his tenure, which when you look at some of the talent they've had, it's you'd hope for a little bit better there. I also think sometimes he plays too many guys. You know, I mean, they've had a deep roster, and so it's sometimes you can have too many guys, and so that's what makes it harder for guys to know their role and buy into the role, because their role's inconsistent. Sometimes they're playing 30 plus minutes, sometimes they're getting 12 minutes. And so it's just hard to kind of find the mold of what your team is going to be when the games become really important, when you're in that situation playing too many guys. He clearly didn't have buy-in from the front office. And look, they have underperformed in the playoffs a little bit. Only one series win in the postseason in this entire era, despite them being, you know, for the last 4 or 5 years or so, a perennial playoff team, except for last year, obviously, with the injuries and whatnot. But I still think Jenkins is a good coach. And I mean, he's been massively successful with the Grizzlies. And I think that a lot of the downfalls of Memphis are things that are out of his control. I think that the offense, the half-court struggles are a lot due to personnel. I mean, Ja Morant is more of a transition player. He is not at his best in the half-court. And the team's been built around a guy that still just cannot shoot from outside. And then you don't really have a lot of other dynamic offensive shot creators in the half court. I mean, Bane and Jaren Jackson can do it a little bit, but that's like not their core strengths on the offensive end. Bane's is shooting. Jackson is spreading the floor a little bit more in the paint type stuff. He's not like a hand him the ball on the top of the key and go get a bucket kind of guy, which they just haven't had a lot of that. So I think a lot of the half court struggles are personnel based. I think that the front office has kind of shuffled guys in and out a little bit too much. They consistently have these really deep rosters, which of course you want a deep roster, but consolidating for upgrades is something that this team just, they haven't done that. And so I think that falls back in the front office. They've had a lot of really good role players that they've just kind of let walk for nothing. I mean, Dylan Brooks, Grayson Allen, Tyus Jones, DeAnthony Melton, Steven Adams, Kyle Anderson, Jake LaRavia, Marcus Smart, all guys that were on this team, were contributors on this team, But what did they get for any of those guys? Nothing significant. Some of them left in free agency for nothing. Some of them were dealt for kind of scraps. And they've replaced some of those guys with other good players. I mean, Zach Edey and Jalen Wells, rookies this year. You know, they've had other guys come in and perform well for them. But again, it's like they haven't upgraded the roster ever. It's kind of just next man up with the next eighth or ninth man that the team drafts or adds in some other capacity. So I think the front office probably has not done as good of a job as they could have given the core guys that they do have. And then they've also had crazy injury bad luck. You know, Ja's only played 51 games per year in his career. He's at 47 played this year. Desmond Bane has only played 55 games per season over the last 3 years. Jaren Jackson Jr. has only played 57 games per year in his career. And the crazy thing is that those three guys have been on the Grizzlies together for 5 seasons. They have played a total of 136 games together. That is 27 games per season. 2022 is the only year that they've played more than 35 games as a collective unit, the three of them, which is ridiculous. Like, they played 11 together in 2021, 29 together in 2023, 9 together last year. This year, they're at 35. Like, how can you expect him to have this team as some juggernaut contender when their top three guys just do not play together? They've had roster construction flaws, in my opinion. And even with that, they've been consistently good. So I think Jenkins is a good coach. I acknowledge his flaws. I get maybe they just want to move on. They didn't see eye to eye, whatever. But to me, the timing is what makes this just bizarre. You know, I mean, 9 games left in the season when they fire him. I just don't see how you can look at that and think that that's best for the team, because I wasn't high on Memphis coming into the postseason even with him. But now, like, with an interim coach, and I know he said he's not going to really shake things up because it's just late in the year, but I mean, this is unprecedented. I genuinely cannot think of off the top of my head, or hadn't seen anything on Twitter about another time where someone got fired this late in the season when they were a playoff team, a top 5 seed at the time of the firing. Like, it's just not something that happens. And so I don't really understand the logic for it. And I really think they should have probably just waited this out, which is why I think that there's more to the story behind the scenes maybe we just don't know about. There must have been some sort of just rift or beef between him and the front office that they just couldn't handle anymore. Because if not, then this makes no sense to me. Genuinely, I don't get it. But I understand. I've seen Grizzly fans online say that, you know, this was maybe a long time coming and it was time for them to potentially move on. So I'm not going to say it's some crazy move to fire him altogether, even though I probably think he's a top 10, at least above average coach in the league. And I think he's going to get a job immediately if he wants one, depending on the spot. But the timing is just bizarre. And I don't see how this puts Memphis in a better place organizationally, especially for this season, to do it at this time. I think they probably should have just waited until the offseason and went from there. But, you know, we will see where this goes for them. But I find it hard to believe that they're going to make any sort of noise in the postseason now, just given the lack of continuity in that standpoint. So up next, I'm going to do a little exercise, just stock up, stock down for some of the playoff teams. You know, there's a lot of teams playing really well, a couple teams that are kind of limping into the postseason right now. So just going to talk through some of the trends and how teams are playing heading into the playoffs. And if I think that the current stretch of play for some of these teams even mean anything going into the postseason. So first stock up team is the Indiana Pacers. And they have just been one of the best teams in the league since the calendar turned to 2025. You know, they started the year 10-15. They've gone 35-16 since then. The only teams with a better record than them in that span are the Thunder, the Cavs, and the Celtics, which have been the three clear-cut best teams all season long. And that includes, they're only 3-4 when Halliburton doesn't play. So they're 32-12 with him playing in that stretch. They have the 6th best net rating in that span. They're 6th on offense, 11th on defense, which is a very drastic difference from last year where they were one of the best offensive teams in the league. Still playing close to that level now, but they were pretty bad defensively. I mean, they were in the bottom 5 of the league for most of last year. This year, they've played much, much better on that end of the court, been an above average team for really the majority of the season. And they pretty much pulled away as the four seed in the East. They're as close as they are to the five seed as they are to the three seed. So it looks like they're going to comfortably sit in that fourth spot. They will have home court advantage in the first round, likely to play Detroit. You know, Milwaukee still could get into that five seed. But regardless, I think Indiana is going to feel pretty good, especially with Dame being out for Milwaukee. But the biggest part of this turnaround has by far been the play of Tyrese Halliburton. So in 2025, since the calendar turned, he is averaging 20 points, 10 assists on 51% from the field, 44% from deep. And since the All-Star break has been even better, 21 points a game, 11 assists per game, 54% from the field, 46% from three. So he is back to playing at least super close to what he had in that stretch last season around the NBA Cup, where people were like having to completely reevaluate the ceiling on what this guy can be. I mean, he looked like a modern day beefed up Steve Nash, basically, with how he was playing. He was averaging like 24-12 or something like that on ridiculous 50-40-90 shooting. And, you know, he's been 50-40-90 for the better part of months now. His scoring is up. His assists are up from where they were to start the year after kind of an uneasy start to the season. I will say I never wavered on him. You know, I know he had some kind of rough patches over the last year or so to start this year, the second half of last year. I think a lot of that probably was due to some nagging injuries with the hamstring, and maybe he didn't feel super confident with his bursts and other things on the court. But we know when he's at his best, he's, I mean, a borderline top 15 guy in the league. You know, the way he controls an offense and is basically a walking top five offense, regardless of the personnel around him. His shooting is back to being at an elite level at really all three levels of the court. And another thing I really like about Indiana is that they play the top teams really well. They're 16-15 versus 500 or better teams, which is one of only six teams in the league to have a winning record against winning teams in the league. And, you know, they're 2-1 versus Celtics. They've beaten the Cavs. They're 2-0 versus the Warriors. They've beaten the Rockets. 2-0 versus the Clippers. They've beaten the Knicks. 2-0 versus the Wolves. 3-1 versus the Pistons. So look at a lot of the top teams in the league, and the Pacers have either beaten them or have a winning record against them. You know, so they play to their competition, which, you know, can be a blessing and a curse, because sometimes they'll drop some games they maybe shouldn't against lesser competition. But come postseason time, it's going to be only good teams they're playing, and they know how to play well in those scenarios. And I know they got swept in the Eastern Conference Finals last year and probably really had no shot of winning that series. But I do just want to call out that, you know, they ran a lot of those games. And I think that I'll just start by saying this. I do think that their run to the conference finals was obviously greatly benefited by injuries to the opposing team. Giannis didn't play a single game in round one against them. Dame missed the last couple of games of that series as well. So a very depleted Milwaukee team that they beat in six games. Then, you know, the Knicks just felt like every game their players were dropping like flies. And by the end, they really had like four, five, six playable dudes on the entire roster. So I get all that. And I acknowledge it. And it is very fair to say that their run was a little fluky. But at the same time, that still happens, that they took care of business. They have gotten the experience of playing in the conference finals and going on a deep run. And so they've been there. They know what it takes to get there, even if it took a little bit of luck. But I'd argue, you know, it always takes a little luck to make a deep run. But even in the conference finals last year, I mean, game one of that series, they were up 3 with the ball with 8 seconds to go and somehow blew it because the turnovers and then the Jaylen Brown 3 and then Boston wins in OT. Game 3, they were up 18 midway through the third quarter without Halliburton playing. Boston finishes the game on a 48-27 run to win that one. Then game 4, they're up 8 with 6 minutes to go. Again, without Halliburton, Boston finishes the game on a 15-4 run. So I know it was a sweep, but the point is they were in 3 of those games. They honestly should have won all 3 of those games, if not at least 1 or 2 of them, just given like how they had played and the positions they'd put themselves in late in those games. And then just given the track record they have, given how Halliburton's playing, you know, they've gotten a nice boost from guys like Benedict Mathurin this year. Nembhard has been just super key to what they want to do on both ends of the court. Siakam's having maybe his best shooting season as a pro. He's just fit in seamlessly as the do-it-all Swiss Army knife second option for this team. I do have concerns, obviously, about their big man rotation because Isaiah Jackson and James Wiseman both have been out for the year for the majority of the season, and they're relying on Thomas Bryant. But I do think Jairus Walker can play some of those backup big minutes. But look, they go a legit nine deep. The center spot is a weakness. But I'm actually pretty optimistic on Indiana as a threatening team in the East. I think that they would easily handle Detroit. I know that they've been a good story, but I don't see them as a real threat come postseason time. And with the, I'll talk a little bit about the Bucks later, but obviously without Dame playing, it's going to be really difficult for them to generate enough offense in the half court to be able to win a playoff series. And so I think Indiana has got a pretty clear path to the second round. And then from there, it'll just be, can they stick around with Cleveland? And I think that they're going to have the utmost confidence in being able to do so because of what they did last year. They've actually got more experience in the postseason than the majority of the Cavaliers roster. And they're a little bit more proven. And we've seen the proof of concept for what it looks like in the playoffs with them. Whereas with Cleveland, it's still a little bit more theoretical projecting what they've done in the regular season this year. So I think Indiana is a threat. And so I'm excited to see how things turn out with them, but they're flying under the radar, but they've just been spectacular here in the second half. Then we'll go over to Stockdown and I will talk a little bit about the Cavs. And they, I know, you know, they've won a couple in a row now, so it's not like the sky is falling for them, but they did have a weird little 4-game losing streak. They're 5-5 in their last 10 games, which, you know, that's good for some teams, or at least okay, but they've only lost 15 games all year. So, you know, a third of their losses have come in just the past 10 games, including losses to the Suns, the Kings, you know, a couple of teams that cannot even buy a win right now. Both of them just like begging to miss the play-in right now, but they both keep losing. So one of them's going to have to make it. But, and really their struggles can mostly boil down to the fact that Donovan Mitchell's shot has just not been there recently. You know, he, in this stretch, he's shooting only 39% from the field, 24% from three in his last 10 games. And they haven't really had anything to play for in a while. So they've locked up the one seed, essentially, even with how well Boston's played recently. It hasn't really been any drama on that front. So it makes sense that they maybe get a little bit complacent and drop a few games. Maybe they shouldn't late in the season. And you know, I think they'd be well served to rest some of their guys heading into the postseason anyway. There's no need for them to just be going pedal to the metal like they have been all year long. And so I don't view this as sort of like any sort of worry for them. You know, we've actually seen a lot of stuff similar to this with teams in the past few seasons. Last year with the Celtics, they had a 5-4 stretch over their last 11 games of last season where they sputtered a little bit, had dropped some games maybe they shouldn't have. And that turned out just fine for them. Then you go back to the 2023 Nuggets, who finished that season 7-10 over the last 17 games. And again, that turned out just fine for them, won the NBA championship. Then you go to the 2022 Golden State Warriors, who actually over the last 28 games were only 12-16. So an even much larger sample of below 500 play. And again, that worked out just fine for them. So, you know, I mean, the three last champions we've had all played some of their worst basketball towards the end of the season. So I would not put any stock into Cleveland's recent struggles. I really think it's probably just complacency given where they are in the standings relative to everybody else. And the fact that, you know, Mitchell hasn't shot the ball super well recently, which he's not going to continue to shoot under 40% for the entire playoffs, for example. But with that said, I still do have some reservations with the Cavs, but it is nothing to do with how they played recently. You know, any reservation that I have with them is completely based on the fact that we've seen them in the playoffs multiple years now with this general core, and they've struggled. You know, the playoffs and the regular season are a completely different animal, and the Cavs have looked very good in a regular season setting and very not so good in the postseason setting. I'm not saying that that will continue because I think that there's lots of reasons to think that they can kind of buck that trend. You know, I think Mitchell has, they're much less Mitchell reliant than they've been in the past. Mobley has taken a clear step up offensively. Garland is just like looks night and day from where he was at this point last season. And I think their supporting cast is a lot better. They didn't have a guy like Ty Jerome off the bench last season. DeAndre Hunter is a different and better option from what they've had at the three spot over the past few years. So again, there's reasons to be optimistic for the Cavs, if not just the fact that look at their record. They're once over 60 games and there's still 5 games left to go. So I get all that. But I still think they have some proving to do is all I will say. But it's not because of the skid. It's just because I want to see in the postseason what it looks like, because to this point it's been underwhelming. But I'm open to the idea that they can look a lot stronger this time around. Okay, moving to the next stock up team, and that would be the team right on the Cavs' heels, the Boston Celtics. And they are peaking at just the right time. You know, before their loss to the Heat this week, which was a little inexplicable, they've had some weird letdowns after long road trips this year. But, you know, it happens. And they're kind of one of those weird teams that, like, plays better on the road, especially in the playoffs. But regardless, before that loss, they had won 14 out of 15 games. 10 of those games were by double digits. I think some of their midseason struggles were largely due just to the fact of weird, bad shooting variance. You know, when you shoot as many threes as the Celtics do, you're going to have some bad shooting nights. But, you know, on the large sample of a whole season, the averages will come around. And so they start to make some more of those shots that they were not making in the middle of the season. And, you know, Porzingis is also back and he's been playing well, 22-8 on 55% from the field, 41% from three since he's come back. They continue to just have a rock solid top eight. Tatum has expanded his game as a playmaker and is really running a lot of the offense now. Last year, I do think there was more through like Jrue Holiday and Derek White. I think Tatum has kind of taken on more of that responsibility as they've almost, I won't say phased Jrue Holiday out, but they've de-emphasized him for sure offensively. I think it's in an effort to kind of conserve him for the playoff time. When he was so spectacular for them in the playoffs last year, just shot the hell out of the ball and was really important on both ends. Then you've got Al Horford, who just continues to defy logic in terms of his age. And, you know, it just feels like a big should not be able to shoot and be as versatile as he is on both ends at his age. But he continues to be exactly that. And sometimes they even look better with him out there than Porzingis. But having that option for either or even playing them together is obviously a huge just luxury for this team. If there are any concerns, I think that, you know, I mentioned Jrue Holiday, the potential decline of him. I won't go as far as to say he's declining, but there it's certainly a question. You know, I mean, his numbers are down across the board, not just volume wise, but his efficiency is significantly down from what it was last year, especially shooting the three ball. And they've tried to like rest him a little bit more this year. So, you know, he's getting up there in age. He's about 34 at this point. So if he's not going to play as awesome as he did in the playoffs last year, then they're going to need somebody else to step up, because he was very, very integral to what they did. I mean, there were discussions about him being in the running for finals MVP last year just because of some of the big games he had. But again, I'm not ruling Jrue as washed. I'm just saying if there were going to be concerns, that would be one of the questions potentially. The other one is obvious, Kristaps Porzingis' health. You know, he's been in and out of the lineup all year long. He missed the majority of the postseason last year. And so can he stay healthy for the playoffs? I think they're going to need him more this year than they did last year. Just another year older for Horford, another year older for Holiday. And again, like I said, it's going to be stiffer competition this time around, I think, just given there's another 60-win team in the East. I think the Thunder loom as a threat in the finals that maybe wasn't there for them last year when they got there. And even just the first and second round, I think, are going to be more competitive just given the teams that they're going to have to play, whether it's Orlando or Atlanta in round one, and then the Knicks, assuming Brunson comes back healthy, are still way better than what they played last year. So the last piece, Jaylen Brown, I think he has regressed a little bit this season. Still think he's awesome, you know, top 25 guy in the league, but his shooting is among the worst it's been in his entire career, and that spans even back to like his rookie season. He's down in the low 30s from three this season. I think that he's just been not as efficient as you would like. Obviously, he's still very capable as a scoring threat from basically anywhere on the court. But again, if he's going to shoot 45%, 46% as opposed to his normal 49-50, and then if he's going to shoot 31-32% from three as opposed to his normal 36-37, like those numbers could catch up to them. So if there's going to be concerns about the Celtics, that's it. But look, to me, they're the clear-cut team in the East still. I've already kind of touched on my slight Cavalier reservations, but look, we've seen it with the Celtics. They've proved last year that, you know, it's going to be really tough for anybody to knock them off. And even with sort of the soft path to the finals, I'm not buying that anyone was going to beat them last year anyway. And they've got the band back together. In some ways, they're better suited coming into this postseason just because of the managing of health for Porzingis and Horford and Holiday, like I mentioned. Pritchard has taken a clear step up from where he was last year. I think Tatum is more of a offensively versatile player this year compared to last. And so I think there's a lot working for them, not to mention the fact that, you know, they're champions now. So they know how to get it done. And I think they're the clear-cut favorite in the East. And so I do think them peaking right now is relevant. I know sometimes it's like, it doesn't always translate, but I think that this is intentional and that they ramped up their team to be playing their best ball at the most important time of the year. So down to another stock down team, and that's going to be the Denver Nuggets, who were previously sitting at 37-19 as the 2 seed in the West. They've gone 10-11 since then, fallen to the 4 seed before last night, but with the Lakers loss, they are still the 3 seed. So it's not like they've plummeted down the standings, but obviously, you know, 10-11, that's a pretty big sample of them playing right around 500, even below 500. And they have not played well against the top teams in the league this year. They're only 14-19 against 500 or better teams. And they've got some real issues that, you know, I feel like we talk ourselves into Denver just because of how great Jokic is, but they're are real concerns about this team. I think defense is a huge one. You know, they're down to 21st in the league defensively this season. When they won it all, they were slightly above average in the 13-14 range for defensive rating. Like, that's a pretty big difference. And they played their best defense of the year in the postseason that season. This year, they have been just not very good on that end, to put it quite frank. I think that they really lack a reliable point of attack defender. They're missing Bruce Brown. They are missing Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. Christian Brown has been forced into this role, and I think he's a good defender, and I think he can handle some of those responsibilities, but I don't know if he's built to do that for 40 minutes in a game, you know, especially some of the quicker, smaller guards that he's tasked with guarding a lot of the time. You've got guys like Peyton Watson and Aaron Gordon who are good defenders, but, you know, Watson's more of like a weak side help defender. He's not like a throw him out on the perimeter and shut down type guy. And same with Gordon. You know, I think he's better at guarding bigger players, guarding up a little bit, than he is about smaller perimeter guys. So they're just susceptible to perimeter guards scoring on them. And I don't know if they have the personnel to be able to, you know, bother guys like that. And also, I think Jokic has just not been as good here over the last year or so. You know, the year they won it, he really stepped up defensively, and there were always concerns about, well, you know, he's not a good defender, one-way player, blah, blah, blah. But then when they won it, you know, he was really solid, and he's got elite hands and instinct, and that's always going to be there. But he defended the paint quite well that year. And this year, it's just, and in parts of last year too, he's just been a step slower there, you know, a little bit more susceptible to getting picked on the defensive end. Even though he's among the league leaders in steals and stuff like that, but that's just because of how good of hands he has. But in terms of just being able to actually protect the paint and stuff like that, it just hasn't really been there. And I think a lot of that also is because he has to do so much for the team offensively that he can't, you know, expend all the energy on both ends of the court. But the center position just ends up being so important defensively, especially come playoff time. So they've struggled defensively. They still, and this has been a talking point for really a year and a half, 2 years now, but their lack of depth and bench, you know, with KCP going to Orlando, Christian Brown moving to starting lineup, it is even more of a thing now. You know, Strother, Peyton Watson, Russ, none of those guys are reliable on a game-to-game basis. You know, Zeke Nagy, Dario Saric, those guys are out of the rotation at this point. Pickett doesn't really get enough opportunity or reps to be able to work his way into the rotation. And then, you know, Bill Simmons said this recently, but they've got a lot of go right ahead guys, you know, just guys that you're like, oh, the ball swings to them wide open. They're like, all right, go ahead, shoot it. We'll live with that. And it's true. They've got a lot of those guys. I even think like an Aaron Gordon, Christian Brown, like you're kind of living with those shots if you're a defense. And so how many guys do you trust shooting the ball. Probably Michael Porter Jr., Jokic, and Murray. Is that about it? And so they're not good defensively. They've got questions offensively outside of their top guys. And then the elephant in the room, Russell Westbrook, you know, he has already had some major late game blunders recently. That game the other night against Minnesota where he gets the ball on a fast break. They're winning, the shot clock's off, 8 seconds left, and he goes for a layup instead of waiting to get fouled. He misses the layup badly and then fouls Jaden McDaniels on a three at the buzzer that they go on to lose. So stuff like that where it's like nobody is surprised when Russ does stuff like that. And then he even had another game recently where he botched a layup late in a game that they really needed in a close game. And so it's not just the one-off things like that. Over this 21-game span where they're 10 and 11, his shooting splits have plummeted. He was shooting really well to start the year. He's down to 41% from the field in that span, 33% from three, 64% from the line. So inefficient. He's averaging nearly four turnovers a game for a guy that's, you know, not even like the first or second ball handler on this team. And he has a negative 7.7 net rating, the team does, per 100 possessions when he's on the court in the span. So they've been bad with him on the court. And, you know, it's one of those like, what wins out? The fact that Jokic is so good and always elevates guys, or the fact that Russ just does this and is going to implode in the worst moments? And, you know, something has to give. And recently it's been Jokic giving, because he has not been able to overcome Russ's just sporadic play and just head scratching decisions and inefficiencies and all of that, that we know Russell Westbrook just is at his worst at come playoff time and in the biggest moments. And so they have a lot of concerns. But even with that, you really can't rule out Denver because just of how absurd Jokic is and how absurd he's been, you know, averaging 30, 13, and 10 on 58% from the field, 42% from three. He just had a 60-point triple-double. He had a 30-20-20 game a few weeks ago. Like, this guy is the best player in the world, even if he doesn't win MVP. And it's just going to be really hard to beat him for out of seven times. And we saw it last year, but man, were they sure close to still winning that series, up 20 at home in a game seven. So let's not act like the Denver run has just completely been shut down since they won it. Like, they very easily could have made the finals last year if a couple things go their way in that game seven, which, you know, I mean, they were up 20. So Denver, I keep going back and forth on. I just feel like they're such a low floor, high ceiling team, because if they don't get a heroic performance out of Jokic, I think they just have so many flaws compared to the other teams in the West. But Jokic is the trump card for them. You know, like, it's just, anyone can look at me and be like, yeah, but they have Jokic and he's going to just will them to wins. I can't argue with it. He's that good. He is that good. I mean, his performance this year, especially if he gets another ring at some point, he's putting him in the top 15-ish all-time kind of player. I mean, like, just if we're talking just peak, you could argue him as a top 10 guy all time right now. I know legacy wise and resume, he's not there, but it's just, that's how good he is. And I think what we're watching is something that we won't see for a while from anybody else. So I'm split on Denver, but, you know, the recent skid's not encouraging. And I think that they're going to have too many flaws to make like the finals, for example, but could they win a series or two or end up in the conference finals just because Jokic? Very, very possible. Okay, next stock up team, we have the Minnesota Timberwolves, who started 32-29. They've gone 13-3 since then. They are the number two net rating team in that span at plus 11.2, which is a dominant number. Only OKC has been better in that span. They are third in offense, sixth in defense over that span, which is way better offensively than they've really been at any point. Even last year when they were a top three seed and really the one seed for a huge portion of the year, they were still only 16th offensively. You know, so they've really come into themselves a little bit offensively. They're still competing defensively as like a borderline top five defense in the league. You know, a lot of things have kind of shifted the other way from the beginning of the year. DiVincenzo is back and he's been knocking down threes like he did last season, 43% in this span on seven attempts per game. Mike Conley, who looked just dead in the water, washed to start the season, he's shown signs of revival, you know, 53% from three over this span. Of course, that's probably not going to be sustained, but, you know, just encouraging to see him not look like a total shell of himself like he had earlier in the year. And then Jaden McDaniels is playing some of the best basketball of his career offensively in this span, 53% from the field, 40% from three, not just as a shooter, but, you know, he's developed a lot more sort of like attack the closeout off the dribble, mid-range, get to the basket type stuff. He's always been a good cutter. So they've got a lot going for them right now. They've got a really solid top eight guys. Jalen Clark has sort of settled into the ninth man for this team. He's somebody I was actually pretty high on coming out of the draft as a defensive specialist, but it was always going to come down to, can he make outside shots for him? And he's been respectable enough to get minutes for them. And I like what he brings to them as a point of attack guy. There still are, you know, real questions with Minnesota, primarily around two guys, Julius Randle and Rudy Gobert, especially come playoff time. You know, Gobert has been really good recently, especially in the second half, but Randle still has the worst net rating among their top eight rotation guys by a wide margin. You know, even in this span of them playing like basically one of the best teams in the entire league, he's only a plus four on the court when he's out there, the team is. And the next lowest rotation guy is a plus nine. So, you know, they've still been good with him out there, but there's a clear drop off with him versus the rest of the guys in this rotation. And then you look at the lineup, their starters with Naz Reid in the Randle spot. So Conley, Ant, McDaniels, Naz Reid, and Gobert. That lineup is a plus 25 per 100 possessions on the season, which is the third best five-man lineup with at least 100 minutes in the entire league this year. And when you put Randle into that spot, they're only a plus 3.5. You know, a lot larger sample, so of course it's going to be closer to the mean. But it's very clear that they have played a lot better with Naz Reid in that spot as more of a connective, complementary piece, floor spacer, rather than Randle, who bogs down the offense a little bit. I think what he brings is still valuable because they do need shot creation, especially in the half court. But, you know, I think he gets the team out of the flow a little bit offensively, and Naz Reid kind of fits more into that flow. But that's not even to mention, you know, Randle's just well-documented playoff struggles. I mean, I've said his numbers a million times on this podcast before. He is probably the worst high volume player performer in his career to this point in the history of the league. He's certainly got a lot of opportunity to change that, but to this point, more turnovers than assists, shooting below 40% from the field, below 30% from three, just been abysmal in the playoffs. And Gobert, you know, there's always going to be questions with him come playoff time. And so that the pairing of them, it's not exactly a sure thing, I'll say that, between the two of them. Randle could easily get played off the court because of how bad he is offensively. Gobert could easily get played off the court because of his struggles defensively when he gets put in a million screen and rolls with dominant perimeter guards, etc. So those are going to be there, those question marks. But I think if Randle, you know, behaves enough, and look, they don't need him to average 25 a game. They don't even need him to average 20 a game. They just need him to shoot a respectable clip, take the shots within the rhythm of the offense. And then I think if he does that, then they can legitimately take out any team in the West that's not Oklahoma City. I truly believe that because I think Ant is that good. I still think their defense is one of the best in the league. I think they got some needed experience in the postseason last year. But I will say they need to avoid the 8 seed. You know, they're the 7th seed, I believe, right now. They get that 8 spot and have to play OKC, they're going to be just dead in the water because of how good the Thunder are. But they are a real threat against anybody else. But it's going to take Randle buying in, which he's done for portions of this year. And I think Chris Finch is the type of guy that's going to be willing to bench him if he needs to, which I don't know if there's every coach in the league would do that. But I think he is one of them. And so if they are willing to do that and or he behaves the way he needs to, then I think that they're a real threat, and I think they're peaking at the right time. And I was always a little surprised that they got off to this slow of a start to the year, but like I said, I mean, a plus 11.2 net rating over their last 16 games, that's like super high level best team in the league type stuff right there. So I'm optimistic about Minnesota, and a lot of that has to do with Anthony Edwards, who I barely even talked about during this portion of the podcast because, you know, I like a lot of the other stuff going on for them as well. Okay, the next stock down team we have is the Grizzlies, which, you know, I talked about them a little bit when I talked about Taylor Jenkins. You know, they started 35-16. They were the 2 seed in the West. They've gone 10-16 since. They fell from the 2 seed all the way to the 8 seed. And they did win last night, which currently puts them in the 6 seed, but that's just because of a tiebreaker. And again, they needed a buzzer beater against Miami to even win that game. They're 3-8 in their last 11. They've lost 4 out of their last 5. They are 20th in defense over their last 26 games. Before that, they were 7th in the games prior to that. As I mentioned, they haven't beaten a 500 team since February 2nd against Milwaukee. So over 2 months since they've beaten a good team, their defense has completely fallen apart. They're plummeting down the standings, and they just have a lot of questions for me. You know, even before this sputtering that they've had, even when they were the 2 seed, I wasn't fully bought in on them. And I've been a Memphis skeptic really for this entire era of Grizzly basketball, you know, with John Moran and Jaren Jackson Jr. and Desmond Bain. I think they're a good team. I understand their regular season success, but I've had real question marks about them come playoff time, and especially this year, because their center rotation is very much a question going into the postseason. Brandon Clark is out for the year, which doesn't sound like a huge deal, but he was really important for what they were doing in the front court. You know, Zach Edey has been okay, but he's managed only 20 minutes a game this season. So can he survive in a playoff setting? I think that was one of the biggest questions about him coming into this draft was, is Edey like a legit rotation playoff guy? I don't think anyone had worries or questions about if he could come in and, you know, average 10-8 in the regular season, be a fine rotation big, but playoffs is a different story, and I'm not sold on it. I think he's going to get attacked defensively and offensively. I'm not sure how much they're going to be wanting to run like post-ups for a rookie come playoff time. And they've actually been better with him off the court this year from a net rating standpoint than with him on. So not that he's been bad. He's been pretty good, but I have questions about it. And then if he's not going to be able to play, then you've got Aldama playing center, which, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call him a center defensively. I think he's more of a, like a power forward or whatever. I mean, he plays more like a perimeter oriented player. They can put Jaren Jackson at the 5, but we've seen that not be a good formula in the past. I mean, when he was playing the 5 at the FIBA World Cup a few years ago, I mean, dude was averaging like 4 rebounds a game. They were getting destroyed on the boards. It just, they couldn't hang with the more physical teams. So I think that that's still going to be an issue if he's playing there. And then that puts a lot on a guy like Jay Huff, who is very early in his career and hasn't gotten big minutes, hasn't played in important spots yet. And so I just, when you're going up against Jokic, when you're going up against some of these bigger teams, Chet, Hartenstein, like I don't know if they're going to have the personnel to be able to contain them. And obviously defensively, they've had issues. And I think a large part of it is because of that. But another part is because their perimeter defense. I mean, who is their point of attack defender? I mean, the best, it's been mostly Jalen Wells this year. Vince Williams can do it in spurts. But like, do you trust those guys to do that for 48 minutes in a postseason series? Because if not, you know, they got rid of Marcus Smart, who was supposed to be that guy for them. It's not Bane. It's not Ja. And it's just, there's a lot of question marks about this team on the defensive end after they played so well defensively to start the season, especially now that they've got an offensive-minded coach running the team now. But the number one reason for me, you know, it's all about reliability of your top guys. And Ja Morant has just not been reliable to play on any given day. He's played 47 games this year. And let me just read through his game log in terms of games played to miss. You know, he hasn't had any elongated stretches of missing games. So it's like, okay, 47 games. It's like, what if, did he miss 20 or 30 at a time? It's like, no, it's just here and there. He's played and not played. Started the season, played 3 games, then missed 1, then played 5, then missed 8, then played 1, then missed 1, then played 5, then missed 1, then played 3, then missed 1, then played 3, then missed 5, then played 4, missed 1, played 2, missed 1, played 2, missed 2, played 4, missed 1, played 5, missed 2, played 6, missed 6, played 4. So he hasn't had a streak of more than 6 games played consecutively at any point in the season. He's only had more than 5 games played consecutively once the entire year. The guy, it's just every other game he misses. I mean, to have that much of a streak, back and forth, play, didn't play. It's hard to do, you know, these nagging injuries. I don't know if there were rumors they were just trying to conserve him, but like, I'm not buying it because, you know, we just haven't seen it out of him. And I pulled out this stat when I was talking about Jenkins, but the trio of Desmond Bain, John Morant, Jaren Jackson Jr., they've been a really successful trio when they played, but they played only 34 games together this season. And in 5 years, five full seasons, they have 135 games played. That is remarkable. You know, that again, that is an average of 27 games played per season between the three of them on the court at the same time. That's like, we talk about teams like Phoenix with Booker and Durant and Beal, they can't stay on the court together. No one talks about stuff like that with Memphis, but it is even more prevalent. 27 games per season between the three of them playing at the same time. That is just not, that's not sustainable for success with your top three guys. And they've just got a shuffling rotation behind them between, you know, they've got 11, 12 guys that could realistically have a claim for minutes, which is a blessing and a curse, because come playoff time, you're not going to win with your 11th guy. Playoff time, it's an 8, maybe 9 man rotation, 10 at the most, but like, you probably don't even want 10. And so who's getting those minutes? Are players going to lose buy-in because they're not getting the minutes they think they deserve, et cetera? So I'll say this. I don't think Memphis is going to avoid the plan. I think they're probably going to be the 7 or 8 seed. And then once they get there, I think the Clippers are better. I think Minnesota is better. I think Golden State is better. So I think that they're going to lose the first game, whoever they play. And then it'll probably be them versus Dallas for the 8 seed. And I think Memphis would win that game. But would I be shocked if AD just went crazy on them and they missed? Like, I can't rule it out. So the fact that they were the 2 seed and now I'm talking about not being totally surprised of them missing the playoffs altogether just tells you the state of the Grizzlies. And I think with the coach firing and there's rumors of Ja and will he be traded in the offseason? And like, I mean, he's just an idiot. Like, did gun celebration in the game last night, got fined again after a formal warning. Like, the guy is just not built to be a franchise player from a personality perspective. He's not reliable. And, you know, I got questions about his playing style too, because he hasn't improved at all over the last 3 years. And there's not a lot of examples of score first point guards that can't shoot translating to success in the playoffs. Try to think of one. John Wall, Russell Westbrook, you know, guys like that where it's like, okay, they're fun, but have they done anything in the postseason? Derrick Rose, you know, these guys that are freak of nature athletes that are really fun and exciting, but when the playoffs come around and it's nut crunch time and the game slows down and you're forced to play half court offense, they struggle and their teams have struggled. And I'm not positive Ja doesn't fit into that group much more so than guys that either do a little bit more playmaking or guys that actually have a reliable jump shot, you know? So we'll see with them, but I think that changes could be coming in Memphis. I mean, we've already seen the first domino of changes coming. So, but I'm not feeling good about where the Grizzlies are at, to be honest with you. Okay. Next stock up team, we've got the Golden State Warriors, who might be the hottest team in basketball right now. You know, they were 25-26 before the Jimmy Butler trade. They've gone 20-5 since then. They are 19-2 overall with Steph and Jimmy in the lineup. They were the 10 seed when they made the trade. They are now up to the 5 seed. They're a plus 9.1 with Jimmy Butler on the court. His stats are modest, you know, 17-6-6 on 46%. But the ripple effect that Jimmy Butler has had on this team cannot be overstated. You know, you watch a game like last night against the Lakers where, you know, he didn't shoot the ball a ton, didn't get close to 20 points, anything like that. But just him being out there on the court affects this team in so many ways. The first one being that this team, before he got there, was 28th in the league in free throw attempt rate, and now they are 3rd in the league. So they went from a team that did not shoot free throws, did not get to the line, created zero rim pressure, to now one of the best in the league. And that's really just completely because of him. He's averaging 8 free throw attempts per game since getting to Golden State. And so that just adds a whole new layer to this offense, more diversity where they're not relying strictly on jump shots, but they can kind of double dip in how they attack on the offensive end. It also has completely revitalized Steph Curry. Before this deal, he was down to under 23 points a game, only 43% from the field, 39% from three, which, you know, that's really low for Steph. I mean, those were some of his career worst numbers since earlier in his career. Since they added Butler, he has averaged over 28 points per game, so a 5.5 point jump. And he's upped his efficiency as well, 47% from the field, now 42% from three. So just Jimmy being out there has allowed for Steph to be much more comfortable getting open looks. He's been more efficient. His volume is up. It's not only just Jimmy Butler's presence and other teams having to give more attention to him, but also, I mean, six assists. He's one of the best playmaking guys for his size and for his position in the entire NBA. And this is exactly the kind of thing I talked about when they made this deal. So, I mean, they're getting more rim pressure. Steph has been completely unlocked offensively in a way that I didn't know if it was still in him. I thought the decline was real, it looked like, to start this year. And then lastly, it has completely revitalized Draymond defensively. The pairing of Butler and Draymond has just been devastating defensively. They've been the best defensive team in the league since they acquired him. And Draymond, who, you know, I don't even think he was on anyone's radar the first half of the season, is suddenly looking like maybe the favorite for defensive player of the year. I don't know if I would vote him that, because, you know, I think that it's really only been half a season of him being this dominant. But you see what a difference it makes when he's got other guys around him that can help him defensively. And I think part of it is he's just more engaged. You know, he feels like they've got a real shot now, which I don't know if he maybe truly believed that before when they were down, you know, in the play-in picture. So the ripple effect of Jimmy Butler cannot be overstated. And it's not just those guys and not just him. You know, Brandon Pajemski was awful to start the season in 2024. He was 40% from the field, 30% from three. But then since coming back from an injury and the calendar turned 2025, he's up to 47% from the field, 40% from three. So shooting better from three than he was from the field overall. He's doubled his point output from 8 to 15. And he's also been a really nice piece defensively for them, you know, guarding some of the tougher guard assignments out on the perimeter. Moses Moody has settled in nicely as that fifth starter, 9 points a game on only 42% from the field off the bench, up to 47% from the field as a starter and 40% from three. So this starting five has been just one of the best units in the entire NBA since Butler got there, between Moody and Pods playing a lot better, Jimmy completely unlocking Steph, Draymond elevating his game defensively, and then just Jimmy doing his thing. And in a lot of games, he doesn't even really have to do much because he's got so much around him that he trusts, especially with Steph Curry offensively. There still are questions with them. You know, they don't have much size. Looney's barely been in the rotation. Quentin Post is the sort of backup center. Then, you know, he's a mixed bag. Sometimes he looks really good and is knocking down shots from outside, but there's question marks about him defensively still. He's a little slow-footed there. When he's not making shots offensively, he's not providing much else. So I do think there are some scenarios where they might be in some trouble against some bigger teams. Like if they play Denver, how are they guarding Jokic? If they play OKC, do they have the size to be able to match up with sort of the twin tower look that OKC has? And then probably the biggest question for me is the Kuminga fit, because, you know, a lot of this success they've had has been with Kuminga out. He's back now, but they've been a -6 points per 100 possession with him on the court since he returned. And just to put into perspective, every single other rotation player in that span is +7 or better. So he has been a huge outlier in terms of just not fitting with the rest of the group. And it's been a little clunky. And part of that is because he's not a great shooter, but they've got a lot of other not great shooters in the rotation between Gary Payton, Draymond, Jimmy, Looney when he plays, throw Kuminga in there. And I'm like, a lot of the other guys that don't shoot well do other things really well. Jimmy as a shot creator, an initiator, a defender. Draymond, we know what he does defensively. Payton is maybe their best point of attack defender. And then Looney gives them rebounding and a little bit more size. And so what does Kuminga do to make up for his lack of spacing and shooting, you know? And I don't totally see his fit on this team. I think the fit with him and Jimmy has been a little clunky just because they both kind of need the ball in their hands a little bit. Kuminga more so, but then you don't want to relegate Jimmy to a spot up shooting role, and you trust Jimmy more with the ball in his hands, and you'd rather have the Jimmy with the ball in his hands. So the Kuminga fit, I'm still kind of sifting through how I feel about that. And I've never been a huge Kuminga guy, but we'll see what kind of role he has. I think obviously he's best as a off the bench guy for this team. But I don't know how many big minutes he's going to be able to get in the postseason just with the current construction of the roster. So, but Golden State's a threat, man. I mean, I think that they could beat any non-Thunder team in the West legitimately because, look, they've just got it all. They compete defensively. They're creative with their schemes on that end to make up for some of their size. They're a pretty good rebounding team despite not having a traditional center in their main lineups. They have more diversity offensively. They're not so Steph Curry reliant. And the other thing is we haven't really seen Jimmy play like playoff Jimmy like we know we can. And so if he plays like he is right now, I think that they've got a high floor and they're a very solid team that can make some noise. But if we get playoff Jimmy, if we get the guy who dropped 50 points on Milwaukee a few years ago in the first round, if we get the guy who carried multiple, you know, so talent-wise Miami Heat teams to the NBA Finals, that Jimmy, then, I mean, the ceiling for this team is just completely thrown out the window. You know, I mean, they who knows how good they could be if he plays at that level. I don't know if he will get there because I think that he's going to continue to defer to Steph offensively. And the reason he was so good there is because he was not deferring. He was like, this is my team. I'm taking over. I'm the alpha dog here. So we'll see if he gets to that level. If he does, then it's going to be really interesting to see what the Warriors can do. But if he doesn't, I still think that they are a very solid, good playoff team that could make a conference finals run. Then the last stock down team we have is the Bucks, and unfortunate news with Dame and the blood clots. You know, he's got the same condition as Wemby, the deep vein thrombosis, which is just kind of strange to see this keep coming up in the league now. They left the door open for him to return, but I'm very skeptical. I mean, the plan starts in 10 days or something like that. We haven't had any updates from him or about him. Wemby's was ruled out for the season with much more time left. I know that is more about where they were in the standings and stuff like that, but I don't know. Until I see some sort of report other than we're optimistic, I'm not going to be optimistic. But they've gone 4-4 without him. But overall, they're 6-9 in their last 15, so they've not played well. It looked like they were going to be comfortably in that 4 seed. They are now falling to the 6 seed. They're not in danger of falling to the 7 because there's a huge gap there, but they were going to either play Detroit or Indiana. Now it looks like it's going to be the Knicks. And if Brunson's back, that's going to be a really tough series for them to win. And I'm not sure that they have the juice to compete in that without Dame. And namely because half-court offense. You know, the reason they traded for Dame is because with Jrue Holiday and Middleton in the fold, they still kind of struggled in the playoffs in the half-court offense. And so without Dame, without Middleton, without Jrue, it could get ugly. You know, I mean, aside from Giannis, it's a bunch of role players. And then Kuzma is forced into the second option. And he just hasn't been good. I didn't understand the trade at the time. I've seen nothing to tell me that that wasn't the correct take. You know, he's shooting 31% from three in Milwaukee, 44% from the field, maybe a little better than he was in Washington, but those aren't good splits. You know, only 67% from the free throw line. The team has been worse with him on the court than off the court in terms of net rating. On basketballreference.com, his net rating is a minus 18. He's been putrid offensively, and now he's thrust into a second option. And I do not care what the rest of the roster looks like or who your best player is. If Kyle Kuzma is your second option, you don't stand a chance come playoff time. And so I was already skeptical about him as their third option. Thought it was a downgrade from Middleton, even with the doubts of Middleton's health. But man, as a second option, Kyle Kuzma he's just not it. And the Bucks, look, they're Giannis has been so great that he could carry them to some wins. You know, I mean, 30-12-6 on the year on 62%. Last night, he had 35-20-17. We saw what he did in the finals back in 2021 when he absolutely carried Milwaukee, 50-point closeout game, averaged 35 a game, one of the highest scoring finals performances ever. We know what he can do. And I don't doubt that he can put up some monster performances. But the thing is, if he averages 33 a game, I still think they're going to lose in like five. You know, in order for them to even like have a chance, I think he's got to average like 40, 15, and 8 or something like that, which I can't sit here and rule out that he could do that because he's that good. But man, they just don't have anything else. And what are they going to do when he's off the court? You're running your offense through Kyle Kuzma, through Taurean Prince, Gary Trent. I mean, it is just bleak for Milwaukee after that. And you know, they played pretty well defensively, but Brook Lopez is asking him to be like a top option offensively at this stage of his career is just not fair to him because, you know, he's so good at what he does, but he's a complimentary piece. You're just asking guys who are underqualified to play roles that they really shouldn't be playing at this point in their career. And so I don't really think they have much chance to get out of the first round without Dame. Even if Dame were to miss 2-3 games and then come back, I just still don't think it's going to be enough because even if Dame played and they were fully healthy against the Knicks, I mean, I think if Milwaukee even wins that series, it's in 6 or 7 games. You know, this isn't like some they wouldn't be favored. I'll say that. The Knicks are really good. I think the Knicks beat them if they're fully healthy. And so without even if you had no Lopez or no like any of their core guys besides Dame or Giannis, I still think it's too big of a blow. So with Dame out, I don't see it. And so the clock is absolutely ticking on Giannis right now. I mean, if they lose first round this year, the Bucks, since they won their championship, which, you know, that's 4 years ago at this point, in 4 seasons, they will have 1 total series win in the postseason. 1 in 4 years. That's just not getting it done when you got a top 3 guy on your team, when you got a multi-time MVP in his prime on your team, when you got a team that is all in, trading away all their first round picks to upgrade around him to go all in on this team. And then if you take out 2021, the year they won it, which obviously it's like unfair to be like, if you take out their championship, but I'm just for the point of the exercise, they have 4 total playoff series combined for the rest of his seasons outside of 2021. So in 11 other years of his career, he has 4 total playoff series wins. And he had 4 total in 2021 alone. So the point is, they have just not had any inkling of success other than that one season. And Giannis is 30 now, and he's given hints that, you know, I want to be in Milwaukee, but I also really want to win. And so I really wonder that if they flame out in the first round this year, if he could ask out. And I think there are plenty of teams poised to, you know, jump in there and pounce on that. And I think Houston comes to mind and would be a great fit. So we will see. Wouldn't shock me if Giannis by the end of next season is on another team. But it's not looking good for Milwaukee right now. And then I've got 2 stock up teams remaining. First one is the Clippers, who started 32-29, the exact same record the Wolves had before their run as well. And they've gone 12-3 since, with 2 of those losses being to the Thunder and Cavs. So very understandable losses. They are 3rd in net rating in that span with a plus 12.8, which again, that is, you know, as dominant as it gets in terms of net rating. They are 5th in offense in that span, 4th defense in that span. You know, they've been a top 5 defense all year long, but their offense is finally catching up. And that's why they've been so dominant recently. And the main reason is Kawhi Leonard. You know, I feel like it's funny. I feel like this exact time of year, like the last 3 years, we've been like, oh my God, Kawhi is playing like Kawhi again. You know, and he's averaging in this span 25 points, 7 rebounds, 4 assists, 53% from the field, 43% from 3, like shooting the hell out of the ball, majorly efficient. Finally, you know, his minutes restriction is gone. He's played 36 minutes per game in this span. And so, look, he was always the wild card with this team. And it was like, we saw how they played at the beginning of the year. They were frisky. They were playing really well defensively, but they were hanging on by a thread offensively. And it was a lot of Norman Powell, a lot of James Harden, and they needed a guy like Kawhi to come in, and he has just been everything you could have hoped for as of recently. And to be honest right now, I've never wavered that like a healthy Kawhi Leonard is still a top 15 guy in the league, and that's what he's playing like right now, legitimately. And so there's always going to be question marks with his health, but if he's healthy, he's at that level, and they got a guy now that they didn't have before. And it's not just him, though. You know, Zubats is having maybe the most underappreciated year of any player this season. He's been all defense level good on the defensive end of the court, career high in points per game, rebounds per game. He has just developed elite chemistry with Harden, especially in the pick and roll. They are a plus 8.8 when both of them are on the court together, which is a dominant number. They've gotten Norman Powell back. You know, his numbers have been a little bit more modest since he came back, but his presence is still felt. And then they had Bogdan Bogdanović, who they added, who has stepped in while Powell was out and in the non-Powell minutes and just been awesome. He was atrocious shooting the ball with Atlanta earlier this year, but is shooting 50% from three since arriving and has picked up for a lot of the dip in volume of Norman Powell to this point. Chris Dunn, Derek Jones Jr., just been great for this team defensively. They still have Batum, Amir Coffey, other good role players. I think the Kevin Porter Jr. trade was an addition by subtraction, shipping him out. I hated the minutes that he was providing them earlier in the year. And since he's been gone, they've been playing a lot better. So, but I do just want to highlight James Harden as well, because I think that he has been legitimately borderline all NBA good this year. And everybody wrote this guy off. He's in his mid to late 30s at this point, but he kept this team afloat when Kawhi was out. You know, he's been durable. He's been consistent as hell. He's turned Zubats into a legitimate threat on the offensive end. He's empowered Norm Powell to be the go-to scorer on this team. Like, as much shit as James Harden gets, he deserves so much love for just the season he's had this year. And it's cool to see a guy at his age just kind of fit into his role. I know his percentages are not good from the field and he doesn't have the same burst getting to the basket. He's not as consistent shooting from deep. I get all that. But if you watch the games, he's just indispensable to what they do. And he's still, what do you have, a 50 bomb over the last few weeks? Like, the dude can still score when he's on. So just shout out to Harden, because this team's probably not even in the position they were in before Kawhi came back if he doesn't play as well as he's played. But the five-man unit of Harden, Powell, Derek Jones Jr., Kawhi, and Zubats, they are a plus 23.9 per 100 possessions this season, which is in the top five for five-man rotations in the NBA this year. So, look, their best five, you can put it up against anybody's best five. But look, the question will remain, can you rely on a team built around James Harden and Kawhi Leonard in the year 2025? And it is an extremely valid question. Feels like the Clippers kind of suck us in this time of year, every single year. And history says the answer to that is probably no. Kawhi Leonard, for as great as he's been, for as great as he's looked at different times throughout all of the last 5 years, it has been 5 years since he successfully made it through a postseason fully healthy. 2021, he gets hurt in the second round. 2022, he misses the entire season. 2023, he gets hurt in the first round. Last year, gets hurt right before the playoffs. And this year, no injury to speak of right now. But, you know, it always seems to sneak up on you right at the most important time. And so their fate will be fully put in the hands of, can Kawhi actually be healthy and play throughout the whole entire postseason? Because if he misses even one, two games of a series, they are probably cooked. If he misses more than that, they are completely cooked. And so it's a fair question, because, you know, history says a half decade of the answer to will Kawhi Leonard be healthy when it matters most, the answer has been no. And even if he's healthy, in the scenario where that does happen, can you trust a team led by James Harden? You know, he's the poster boy for coming up short in the postseason in this, you know, generation of basketball. And he's patented his 2-for-11 shooting performances over the years in the postseason. And he just has not shown up when it's mattered most. And so can they overcome one of those things? Maybe. But the risk that looms for both of them to potentially come to the forefront in the postseason is probably too great to be able to really trust this team or put too much faith in them as a legitimate, you know, postseason threat. I think if everything played out perfectly for them, I think I wouldn't be shocked to see them in the conference finals. But, you know, when I'm making my picks, you got to take that stuff into account. And realistically, history says one of them is going to go poorly. Either Harden's going to play so badly that they can't overcome it, or Kawhi's going to get hurt, or both, or something else happens. You know, I mean, they've got everything you could want on paper, But the game's not played on paper, and this has not been a team that has performed as it should on paper. And so can they make something interesting in a series? Sure, because I think they can play well enough and be healthy enough for a series. But for a long run, I'm just not putting my eggs in that basket, unfortunately, even though I do think they are truly dangerous if everything can, you know, kind of go their way, but it just hasn't gone their way in recent years. Then the last team I'll talk about as a stock up team is the Houston Rockets. And, you know, they started the year 32-14. They had a rough stretch of going 5-11. A lot of that was without Fred VanVleet while he was hurt. But since then, they've gone 13-2. They're maybe the hottest team in basketball outside of OKC, who's won 11 in a row. But they're the number two net rating team in that span at a plus 13.2. So, you know, all-time good level right there. They're top three in offensive rating, top three in defensive rating, where they've been all season long. They have taken full control of the number two seed in the Western Conference. They're three games up with five to go, so they've all but locked that up. And this is just a classic case of a team that is has a total that is greater than the sum of the parts, because do they have the most firepower and star power in the league? No. Do they have the most pedigree and experience? No. But, you know, they've just got a rock solid 8-9 man rotation that competes defensively, that attacks the glass offensively. They're first in the league, rebounding 32% of their own misses. They take care of the ball. They turn it over less than 12% of the time, which is also among the league leaders. And that combination allows them to really control the possession battle. So even though it can get a little ugly on offense at times, it doesn't really matter, because one, they're so good in transition offensively with the athletes that they have. And then two, like I said, they just control the ball more often than not. And so Amen Thompson, Tari Eason, those guys have broken out in a big way, especially on the defensive end of the court. Steven Adams is kind of been revitalized and impacting teams like he always does as a dominant offensive rebounder. We know what Şengün does. We know Brooks, Green, VanVleet are a big part of what this team does, particularly as shot creators. And then Ime Udoka, you know, in my opinion, one of the five best coaches in the league, despite his off the court issues in the past. But with all that said, I'm probably going to disappoint some Rockets fans here, if any of you are listening, but I don't believe in this team as a real postseason threat this year. And I'll also just say that this season, regardless of the postseason outcome for Houston, they could get swept in the first round and it will be a resounding success for them. You know, this is just way better than they ever could have hoped or any expectations on them to be a top two seed, 50 plus wins, you know, get the postseason experience that they need. It's a wildly successful season, regardless of the outcome in the postseason. But there's a couple of reasons why I don't really see it with them. Even though they've been so just consistently good in the regular season, despite that one little stretch they had where they struggled. And first part is they haven't taken the playoff losses. I always talk about this. Last year with Oklahoma City, they were the one seed. Yet I just didn't see it out of them in terms of could they really contend. And we saw that play out in real time against Dallas in the second round. And look, I know they won a playoff series, but again, they played a Pelicans team that did not have Zion Williamson. So if Houston was playing a Zion Williamson-less Pelicans team, I think they could win that too. But you know, the playoffs field this year is just tougher. The bottom seeds are, I mean, you could argue there's no difference between the 2-8 seeds legitimately this season. And so even if Houston gets that 2 seed and they play the 7 seed, regardless of who it is, it's going to be a really tough matchup. And so they're not going to have the benefit of like, oh, we earned playing a lesser team because we're the 2 seed, because to me, it's interchangeable. You know, any of those teams could win a round or two, beat really anybody except for the Thunder. And so they're going to have to take their losses to probably a more experienced team. If you look down the Western Conference standings right now, all the other playoff teams have been to the playoffs. They've been there. A lot of them have won championships. You know, they're going to end up playing a seasoned veteran team most likely. And Houston just cannot compete on that front. Aside from that, they are just not, they're not going to have the best player in really any series, I think. You know, it's just unfortunate, but they lack that star power. And look, a team can win a series when they don't have the best player. But in order to do so, you've got to have like a pretty like undebatably better roster and team around the whole group to overcome the star power on the other side. And that's the other thing. I don't think Houston necessarily has that either. Look at their best five and look at the Clippers' best five or Minnesota's best five or Golden State's best five. It's like they're very comparable. So I don't think that they're going to have that advantage. And then to think about when it's nut crunch time, you know, the game slows down. It's more of a half court game on both ends. Houston's going to defend like crazy, and that's going to translate. But on the offensive end, I think they're going to really struggle because, you know, this season they're in the bottom third of the league in offensive rating in the half court, which, you know, not a good formula come playoff time. We've seen that same thing kind of play out with Memphis, but I think Houston struggles even more than a team like Memphis does in that front. And it's because they just don't have reliable, efficient shot creators like these other teams do. I mean, their top three perimeter scoring options are Fred VanVleet, who shoots 38%, Jalen Green, who shoots under 43%, Dylan Brooks, who shoots under 43%. Sure, they can run some stuff through Şengün, but it feels like Green and VanVleet are really their go-to guys laying games, and I just don't trust either of them. To put those guys up against Kawhi in a series, up against Anthony Edwards in a series, up against Steph Curry and Jimmy Butler, like, just go through the list. Like, they just are not going to be able to match the production and efficiency and proven commodities that we know their opponents are going to have that have done it and performed in the playoffs. And so, again, Houston, phenomenal story, great year. And I think after this year, this is not a me saying that I don't like their core or their team going forward. They're in a very advantageous spot. They have a ton of ridiculously good young talent. And they have a lot of opportunity and assets to potentially add to this. You know, they could try to run it back, mostly do fringe moves on the margins, or, you know, they could go out and add a big fish. Kevin Durant, probably available. I'm sure Phoenix would love to get their picks back. You know, if they make a move like that, this could be a completely different discussion next year. I just think that this year it's going to be a tough sell. And sadly, I'm probably going to have them beating anybody except maybe Memphis if they end up playing them, just because I think a lot of the other teams they're going to play are going to be able to match what they do defensively and have a massive advantage on the offensive end in the half court and from an experience and just pedigree level. So I'm sorry, Houston fans, even though they played really well recently, the playoffs are a different animal. And I think that they're going to learn that the hard way this year. But they'll be better off for it. You know, they will come back better next year, regardless of what they do with their transaction cycle, better off for it because of the experiences that they get this year. Okay, so switching gears a little bit, I want to talk about the MVP discussion a little bit, as well as just the Oklahoma City Thunder as a whole and the season that they're having. And I just want to start off by saying, so I think Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is the clear pick for MVP, but I want to clarify that and say that I don't think anyone who thinks Jokic is the MVP is wrong. I don't think that, I'm not trying to convince you or tell you that that's a bad take or anything like that. I think it's an extremely fair opinion. And what he's doing is historic, and we might not see anything like it like for a long time. And the stat lines he's putting up and his averages and the efficiency and all of it, elevating a slightly underwhelming Denver team to even just be in the contender conversation is super impressive. So I think that anyone who thinks Jokic is the MVP, your opinion is valid. I'm not invalidating that. I'm just more explaining my personal thought process for why I would pick Shai this season. There's a lot of good reasons. He's leading the league in scoring at 33 a game, just under 7 assists. Crazy efficiency, 64% true shooting, 52% from the field. His advanced stats are just on another level. 16.4 win shares. He leads the NBA in defensive win shares. His offensive rating is 130, defensive rating 107. Both incredibly impressive, especially for a guard. The type of scoring season he's had is just one of the all-time greats. You know, he has 48 games of 30 or more points. He has 12 games of 40 or more. He has 4 games of 50 plus, which is 4 times as many games as he has under 20 points. So he was 4 times more likely to drop 50 than 19 this year, which is just ridiculous to say. This season's really been up there with like all-time stuff, you know, prime Michael Jordan. This is legitimately a better season than any season Kobe had. When you just look at the efficiency and the team success and all that, like up there for one of the best guard seasons ever with, 2016 Steph, 2018 Harden. It is put it up there against any of those years for these all-time guards. And it's really MJ level type stuff that he's doing. If you just look at seasons for guards in which they scored 30 plus per game and won 60 plus games in that season, it's only been done 5 times before this. MJ did it 3 times. Steph did it once. Harden did it once. All 5 of those seasons resulted in an MVP. If you expand it to not just guards, but all players to win the scoring title and then also win 60 plus games, Kareem did it twice. MJ did it 5 times. Shaq did it once. Steph did it once. Harden did it once. The only one of those years that did not result in an MVP was Michael Jordan in 1997 when he finished second to Karl Malone, which is a notoriously controversial MVP. A lot of people retroactively were like, damn, we should have voted for Jordan because he ended up beating Malone in the finals. And then he came back the next year and won it and beat him again in the finals. And so, you know, basically it's been a shoe-in for MVP, history says, if you score at the rate he does and have the level of team success that he does. And that's not even to mention the elite all-time level efficiency that he is doing it at for a guard, especially his advanced numbers, like check every box as well. And I think, I mean, aside from the individual numbers, because, you know, Jokic has got all those same individual numbers. They're different, but you know what I mean? Like he checks those boxes. But the Thunder are 14.5 games up on the number 2 seed in the West. A stacked, loaded Western Conference that's been a bloodbath all year long. They have just ran through it. They dominated it, made it look easy. They're 64-12. They're on pace to win 69. They're on pace to have the third most wins in NBA history behind only the aforementioned 96 Bulls and 2016 Golden State Warriors. They have a plus 13.4 net rating, which is tied with the 96 Bulls for the best net rating in NBA history of all time. So history says this is quite literally maybe the best team of all time from a just performance and results perspective. They're 29-1 versus the East. That's the best record versus any one conference ever. They have 50 double-digit wins, which is tied for the most in NBA history with 6 games to go. They're probably going to break that record, which is insane to say out loud. The Nuggets might not even win 50 games total. And the Thunder have won 50 games by double digits. That is ridiculous. Like, they're just cruising to these wins over the span of the season. They've been insane defensively. They have the third best relative defensive rating in NBA history, which basically means how much better were you than league average? Because obviously, it's really hard to compare offensive and defensive ratings across eras because they're just trending up across the board. But if you look relative to league average, they are 8.5 points below the league average for defensive rating, which is third all time behind only the 04 Spurs and the 08 Celtics, which they're only a couple decimal points behind those teams. So it's not even crazy to think that if they've finished super well, they could even get first there. But regardless, one of the best defensive teams that we've literally ever seen. And it's not like this was smooth sailing for them either. They've had a lot of injuries and adversity. I mean, Chet missed 48 games this year, more than half the year. Isaiah Harden's team missed 22 games earlier in the year. Jalen Williams has missed 12. Alex Caruso, their big offseason acquisition, he's missed 26. It's just been next man up mentality. I mean, they've started Jalen Williams, J-Dub, at 6'5 at center for like weeks at a time when both their bigs were out. Like, it's just crazy. They didn't skip a beat with no matter who was out of the lineup. And the one constant there is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Because he's just been durable as hell. He plays every day. He's so damn consistent. Doesn't have bad games, it feels like. And he does it on both ends. And so I think, one, that's kind of why I have Shai as my MVP. Two, I think the Thunder are maybe not being talked enough about as one of the greatest teams of all time. I feel like we did this with the Celtics last year where people were doubting them. And it was like, guys, you realize they're like, all the numbers say they're one of the best teams ever. And that's what all the numbers say about this Thunder team too. So I've firmly moved them into my championship favorite ahead of Boston, which I had Boston, you know, maybe a month ago as my favorite. I think that OKC has earned it. You know, you don't put up those kind of gaudy numbers accidentally as a fluke. It just doesn't happen. You look at all the top 10 best net rating teams of all time. I think 9 of them won the title, and the one that didn't was in the same year as another team that also had one in the top 10. So obviously they couldn't both win it. And we've seen Cleveland was up there before, and they've since fallen down. OKC's only gotten better. They're on an 11-game win streak right now. Like, it's not crazy to think they could run the table and hit 70 wins. Like, they're just so dominant this year. And I think we just need to acknowledge that and not be surprised when they win it all, even though that it's crazy to think that they're so young and they have so many assets to set up themselves for the future, but they really are that good right now. So I just wanted to call that out before we go through the playoffs. And if they cruise through it, it'll be a moment where we look back and we're like, yeah, we probably should have seen that coming, just like we did with Boston last year. And then lastly, I just want to touch on one final last thing. Talk about Josh Giddey and just kind of look back to that deal with the Bulls and the Thunder and talk about, you know, how silly it was that everyone was complaining, saying, oh, well, can't believe Chicago didn't get a pick back. Well, they didn't need a pick back because they got a much better, much younger player in return. You know, Alex Caruso, really good player, has been impactful on the Thunder. He's 31 years old. He's only played 50 games this year. He's injury prone in general. He hasn't even played 20 minutes a game for them. And you know what? He's shooting lower percentage from 3-point range this year than Josh Giddey, which is one of the main reasons they dumped Giddey in the first place. But since the All-Star break, Giddey's averaging 21 a game, 10 rebounds, 9 assists, a near 20-point triple-double, 50% from the field, 47% from three. He is up to 38% from three on the season on career high volume. And, you know, the Bulls are 9-7 in that span. He had a half court game winner to be the Lakers on one of these games. Like, he's playing out of his mind. He's looking like an all-star level player. And a lot of it is because he's being unleashed as a ball handler and a primary initiator, which, you know, the reason he looked so bad on Thunder in the playoffs last year was because of his role. Not because he got worse. It was because they were boxing him into a role that he wasn't fit to play. They wanted him to be a 3-and-D player. Well, guess what? That's not what he is. He's at his best with the ball in his hands, running an offense, orchestrating everything. And that's exactly what he's been doing for the Bulls. A lot of his threes now are coming much more in rhythm. Seems like he's more of a kind of off the dribble shooter than he is a stand in the corner, catch and shoot guy. And the percentages show that he's improving in that aspect of his game. And he's not being relegated to the corner. And so I just wanted to do a small little victory lap on this because, you know, I wrote an article when this deal came out talking about how I thought this was a huge win for the Bulls. I know a lot of people didn't view it that way, but I just wanted to kind of circle back and say, you know, it's crazy because he's only 22 years old. That's the part that no one even talks about. He is so goddamn young. There are rookies this year that are older than he is by multiple years. And so they are probably going to have to pay him $100 million this offseason and an extension. And you know what? He's worth it, in my opinion. What else are the Bulls spending their money on? I mean, he literally has 18-9-9 on efficiency type of upside. Like, he could be a borderline all-star, I still think. I mean, he's like 5 years away from his prime or something like that. So I've always been a Giddey guy. I think that the approval rating pendulum swung way too low for whatever reason, because I think a lot of people were high on him before too. And then out of nowhere, it suddenly was all anti Giddey discourse just because of one playoff series that, again, I think it was just not fair because of the situation he was put in. So good job for the Bulls. One of the only trades they've gotten right over the last 5 years, but at least they got one right, you know. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. Thank you so much for listening. Like I said, we've only got about 5 or 6 games left for every team to play in. Tournament starts in about 10 days or so. Playoffs will follow after that. So it's right around the corner. And, you know, I was going to talk through some of the potential matchups on this pod, but realized, you know, that's a waste of time because there's still so much seed jockeying to figure out. And, you know, everybody in the 3-8 in the West could really switch at this point. And so I figured let's just save that for when the matchups are actually solidified. So I'm very excited to talk through all of the first round matchups, make my picks, my predictions, not only for the first round, but for the finals and the rest of the playoffs. So I will have all that content coming out as the regular season comes to a close and the postseason starts to kick off. And then, you know, we're going to ramp up and do a lot more frequent episodes once the playoffs start, similarly to what I did last year. And yeah, it's going to be a lot to discuss, obviously, with the postseason coming up, and it should be a really fun playoffs this year. But with that said, thank you so much for listening, and I will chat with you soon.